Welcome back to Remember What's Next, Season 3. This is the podcast where we explore the intersection of Jewish history and modern-day challenges. I'm Ellie Bass, a Jewish educator, healer, and coach, and joining me once again is Rabbi Ken Spiro. He's an author, educator, and world-renowned Israel tour guide and historical pundit. In this season, we'll be examining the vital importance of Jewish unity. Throughout history, the Jewish people have faced countless obstacles and challenges, yet have always managed to survive and thrive due to their unity and sense of collective purpose when we can muster it. We'll examine the clashes and collaborations between ancient traditions and modern innovations and explore how these interactions can shape a better future for everyone. We're jumping into the unique challenges and opportunities facing the Jewish community in the modern era, and how our unity can help us confront these challenges and build a brighter future for all. So join us on this journey of discussion, learning, and inspiration as we remember the past, discover the present, and explore what's next for the Jewish people. Welcome back, everyone. Rabbi Ken Spiro, welcome back.
Good to be back always.
We're continuing our conversation from the last episode. So we were starting to, you basically set us up, teed us up, so it is, for a conversation around the idea of the end of days. So if you haven't listened to the last episode, it's helpful to go back and listen to that to sort of understand where we're coming from today and all of the caveats and all of the things that make us uncomfortable about this conversation. But we're going to go into more detail today. So where should we start? I know you brought up a few different ideas, the idea of Gog and Magog, the Messianic era, the Ishmaelite exile. How do we organize these ideas and where should we begin to be able to understand them?
So I think, Ellie, a good place to begin is to kind of pick up, again, where we left off this whole concept of Messiah, which, again, people, it seems kind of weird to people. And we also, First of all, people have, I speak a lot on it. I even speak to Christian audiences on it about why we don't recognize Jesus as the Messiah. It's not the title of the class. That's too in your face. But the people have a lot of misinformation about it. I mean, it's kind of a ubiquitous concept in Western thinking now. And like we talked about last week, it's kind of seeped into even the plots of the Hollywood epic movies of sort of an individual who's the catalyst to get humanity, to confront evil and get humanity back to the light, so to speak.
Right.
So I know most people, as soon as you get into this topic, they start to get a little, like people who are like rational, they start to get uncomfortable.
Yeah, totally. It's super antsy. Like, that feels very like either religious or magical or superhero Marvel movie, like all of it. It just feels like, oh, suddenly we've crossed into fantasy. Whereas everything else we were talking about is more historical and reality based.
Right. So that's exactly the point that people like, okay, now he's not sounding rational anymore.
Right.
You know, like right. I said, we have to, I mentioned this when we talked about this last week, you know, 9/11 was giving us an experience of watching something unfolding before our eyes live, which is one of the great features of the modern world is events unfold live before your eyes. You don't have to wait to hear about them or read about them after the event. You can actually see them happening, but experiencing things that seem like, no, this can't be happening. This is like a Hollywood movie. How can this be? And it is. So
it's funny, just as a quick caveat, like, when I talk about prophecy, even in my classes, you know, I say the same way someone 2000 years ago would hear the idea of a smartphone and think that you were crazy and unstable and talking about fantasy and left the realm of reality is the same way now that we talk about 2000 years ago, the technology of prophecy. Right? That we can't imagine it. And it sounds fantastical. And it seems like magic. So in a way, what we're dealing with is, you know, societies that just can't imagine what the reality is of that particular time. So it sounds like legend or myth or fantasy, but it really is, you know, these are technologies that don't exist now. So we can't imagine that they were real.
Exactly. It's even more weird than that. I have a friend who grew up in the South Pacific with these, you know, these primitive, you know, cannibal, made, you know, really, really Stone Age people who deal with the spirit world, and to them, it's incredibly real. I mean, mm-hmm. for them, it's completely normal and acceptable. Things they say, things come out of their mouths and stories that to us seem completely weird and impossible. And she told me when she tells them about like this box with wheels that travels on its own, or this thing with like this metal tube with wings that flies in the sky, they laugh at her like she's out of her mind.
Right.
So it's the exact same thing. So what we have to recognize is that we have kind of been cut off because we've evolved in a world where everything needs to be understood scientifically and technologically, even though I believe most people truly really want to believe and actually do believe in things that are outside of what we can explain scientifically. Stuff is really out there. So, but it's not a matter of leap of faith. That's the really interesting thing, which is what I think we should really focus on. Because as weird as it is, and we talked about this the last episode, that, you know, doesn't mean there's going to be a suspension of the laws of nature. Like I said last time, you know, the infinite creator of the universe, the ultimate game programming infinite being that made the scenario in which we live in, which is called reality, can do whatever he, so to speak, likes. But generally he doesn't like to suspend the laws of nature. So we have to also learn to develop a sensitivity to an understanding that a lot of what we call supernatural or weird will happen in very natural ways. But what is interesting is because we have this concept, which goes back thousands of years, precisely because it's a mainstream part of Jewish thought, right. The notion of messianic redemption is not something far out there in Judaism. It's, you know, the Rambam has Maimonides, the great medieval Jewish scholar, based on his philosophical writings on Jewish worldview, they put together 13 principles of faith, which are by the way, is the single, you can find it in any prayer book or any siddur. It's right after the morning prayers. It's the single best one-page summary of what Judaism really believes, starting with the reality of God and the Torah and everything else. It really is. It's 13 points and encapsulate everything, and it goes in a certain historical order also. And the 12th of the 13th is Ani Mamin Bemunishlema Baviata Mashiach Vafa Pishit Mamechakelo Koyom Shavo. I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah, and even though he may delay, I always jokingly say, of course he's going to delay. He's Jewish. If he was Swiss, he'd come on time.
It's Jewish time.
Even though it's a delay, I'll wait for him. But the point to focus on is.
And then we'll all keep talking every time he tries to talk.
Belief in this period of time that is spearheaded by a certain individual who is this catalyst for this entire transformative point in human history is a fundamental point of Jewish worldview. And again, like I said, if we learn to develop an appreciation of how totally supernatural and everything Jewish history is in every respect, the highs and the lows, as we said previously.
Right. It starts to feel like not so out of it.
Yeah, the possible, like we saw 9/11, the impossible is then possible, and then it becomes probable and likely, which is right. What we're seeing now, by the way, which is exactly what we're seeing.
For sure. For sure. Okay, so how do we understand this idea of a messianic era, a Messiah? What do we need to know about this in order to be able to then go to the rest of, say, of the idea of Gog and Magog and the Ishmaelite exile? What are the pieces we need to understand? Because I definitely get a lot of questions like, what does that even mean? Messiah, Mashiach, like, how do we know? What is that going to look like? Is it going to be a guy? Is it going to be a girl? How do we, you know, there's one thing about everybody is going to unanimously agree. We can't even imagine that in the Jewish community. Like, how do we know? What do we do with this?
Right. So I'm gonna stay away from the specific description of the Messiah personally, because I think it's such a big topic. We should do it in a different episode because it really is a big topic. But the Messianic era, in terms of the time frame, which we have discussed previously, the notion that we know that we Jews introduced the idea, you know, that history is a control process leading to a destination. There's a creator in the story who didn't just create the world, but he sustains and supervises it. There's a purpose to the story, which if you go back to the very first episodes we did, you know, we went through this introduction to Jewish history, the notion that God, the infinite creator of the universe, creates a world that he can give. The ultimate thing he can give is connection to himself. The purpose of creation, Judaism teaches, is pleasure. And the highest level pleasure is relationship with God, connection. So that's the Jewish understanding of why the entire the universe is here and the human race is on the planet Earth. Is just to, as we say in 1960s slang, hang out in the garden and groove on the Shekhinah, which is one of the many Hebrew terms for God's essence.
Right.
And but humanity
also
blew
like relationship, like all the like the relationships, relationship with self, relationship with others, relationship with God, like that the whole
All
common
relationships.
denominator is relationship.
Exactly. It's all about relationship, and all relationships we have in the physical world are some are on some level reflection on and part of our relationship to God, like a parent to a newborn, a husband to a wife. They're all there. This, you know, there's this, some relation. It's all about understanding at a fine level what the infinite relationship is about, the that infinite light. And since that's the purpose of creation, without going through a whole introduction to Jewish history, we blew it. Beginning with Adam eating from the tree of knowledge and then making the biggest mistake in the world. He blamed his wife, which men have been paying for since. But the Jewish people came along, and basically Abraham came along and chose for himself and for us this unique responsibility. Our responsibility is to, we say light to nations, is to be the role model, not to conquer or convert, but to bring humanity, get humanity by doing it right back to relationship with God. People will say, you got, it's like you have a business model that works. People say, okay, we want to be successful in business. We're going to follow your business model. You know, so we are going to be the spiritual business model for humanity. And that's what the story of human history is ultimately all about. That is the plot of human history. We usually don't see it. It's the subtle plot that runs through and connects everything. But ultimately, what it's all about is humanity returns to God. Jewish people lead the way, which also explains in many ways the outsized role that the teeny tiny Jewish people, 0.2% of the world's population, play in this world, which is most manifest by the hyper-focus the world has on the Jewish people in Israel, which you can see happening before our eyes now with the conflict in Gaza, that the standards that we are held to are not held to any other people on the planet Earth, because even on the deepest subconscious level and humanity's collective spiritual awareness or self-awareness, even if they're unaware of their awareness because it's subconscious, is that the Jewish people play some unique role in getting humanity back to the garden, so to speak, back to the relationship with God, back to this highest level of pleasure. And like we've also mentioned before, that just like all the great Hollywood epics, that happens obviously at the end of the story. I mean, the end can come sooner or later. We get to the end one way or another. I always say the long road, the hard road, the quick road, There's a lot of different ways of getting it. We do get there, but obviously the climax, which is what the Messianic era is all about, it's the great tipping point that we get to when it becomes very clear, not overnight, but it becomes very clear that this is what it's all about. And then clarity returns to the world. Truth returns to the world. The focus on relationship with God becomes the end game for all of humanity.
I think it's such an interesting point that you made related to being a role model, because I think one of the major libels that's out there right now is that Jews and Israel are colonizers, which suggests that we're into empire building and taking over other people's lands and making everybody like us, which is just so absolutely antithetical to the Jewish viewpoint, which is we don't proselytize. We discourage people from converting. It's not that we don't let them in, but we're like, are you sure you really want to do this? Because this is a lot. And we definitely don't try to we're not trying to make the entire Arab world Jewish. That's not what we're doing. We're saying this small piece of land the size of New Jersey is the Jewish homeland. The rest of you, zeigazent, enjoy. Like, you can do whatever you want. And this idea of being a role model to the world is we're showing the way, but everybody has their own way to get there, right? We're not trying to make everybody say Jewish prayers or do it the way that we do. And I just think it's such a fascinating thing to understand about being both Jewish and the point of Israel, which is absolutely the opposite of what people are saying about us in the world, which is that we're trying to colonize, which is, it's just not true. It's fascinating.
It is true. We're not trying to colonize. I always say the only Jewish empire in history has been Hollywood. And it hasn't been a source. It is completely created by Jews, Eastern European Jews in the early 20th century. And also nuclear energy, by the way, the entire Manhattan Project that made the A-bomb in Los Alamos. And, you know, it was all Jews from Robert Oppenheimer on down. But our empire is an empire of ideas. It's not a physical empire. Without going into the, you know, Jewish connection to the land of Israel, because indigenous people have been there for thousands of years, cannot colonize their own piece of real estate. That's just a complete warped mistake on history. That's a separate thing. But there is something to even the fact that there's such, we seem to pose such an outsized threat to the world. It's never really a physical threat, but it's always the idea that that Judaism has always believed, which has made us so popular. This is sarcasm, that there is only one ultimate truth in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, there's only one reality. There's God. You know, God, we have a unique responsibility because we chose for ourselves a unique mission to get humanity back to God. But God is the God of all humanity. Mm-hmm. You said something, which is, I'm not sure it's 100% the way I would say it. You know, our job is not to, we don't colonize. Like I said, we don't conquer. Maimonides, he said it beautifully. And Maimonides, I urge anyone who's interested in reading this, because there is no tractate in the Talmud or in the Mishnah, the oral law, the laws of Messiah, the Messianic era. Maimonides does the best job in his book, in his 14-volume book called the Mishnah Torah, where he summarizes all of Jewish law. The specific volume is called Sanhedrin. It's the laws of kings and their wars. He goes into the clearest description of Messiah. And now I'm just literally more or less giving the exact English translation of what he says. He says, the sages and prophets did not long for the Messianic era in order to rule the world, Lord, to subdue the nations, but to be free to pursue Torah and its wisdom. At that time, there'll be no hunger and no war, no jealousy and no strife. The entire world will be entirely occupied to acquire the knowledge of God. As it says, the world will be full of the knowledge of God as the waters cover the seas. So it's not that the whole world is converted to Judaism. The point is, by the way, it's not that, you know, some people get to it in their own ways. And again, I don't really want to go into this now in detail, but the whole world becomes, Jews are Jews, and the rest of the world becomes Noahides. The Noahide laws, and we should maybe save this for a later discussion on the whole deeper concept of Messiah and his mission. But the Noahide laws are like Judaism light, the seven rules that God gave to Noah. I said, Adam only had one, don't eat from the tree. He didn't listen. Noah had seven. And I said, Abraham, then we got finally get to the Jews. We get 613. I always say, thank God we got it right, because the next group of people coming along exponentially would have had like 30,000 commandments. I don't know. But it's you know, there's a whole discussion. It can't be that Jews are right and Christians are right or Muslims are right. Judaism, these religions that the two offshoots come from Judaism are exclusive in their worldview. I mean, a Christian will say only belief in Jesus is going to get you to heaven. And a Muslim will say Muhammad's the final prophet and Jews and Christians got it wrong. We Jews are, by the way, the most inclusive. We say we have a unique responsibility to God, but you don't have to be Jewish to go to heaven. The righteous of the nations of the world have a place in the world to come. But again, so it's about us giving the world clarity and truth, and the world lining up behind us and saying, okay, you're doing it right. Okay, you know, we're going to follow.
Right. That we're with, like, everybody kind of finally steps into a diverse practice, but unified awareness.
Yeah. But it's sort of like a kind of, you know, you're the psychology person of the two of us, you know, the idea of cognitive dissonance, right? You know, which was best stated by Simon and Garfunkel in the song, The Boxer, a man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. Mm-hmm. When people are invested in an idea, whatever it is in their life that they put so much into, whether it's their money or their beliefs or their reputation, it's going to be very hard to move them away from that. Yep. So you kind of look at what happens at the end of this historical process, because it has to happen this way. You know, all of human history is this great interplay between God's infinite knowledge and control, because we don't manipulate him. There's nothing you can do to change. God doesn't change his mind, but he lets us play around with the story, so to speak. all of history is moving towards this process. But as we get towards the end, we're gonna get a lot of pushback, because there's a lot of cognitive dissonance, religious cognitive dissonance, moral cognitive dissonance, people not wanting, because what comes along with this is what's really important. Now, this is the really big thing between people who just want to be spiritual and what Judaism is teaching the world. It's not just about, you know, because we live in a physical world, if we're just souls, we wouldn't need any regulations. Souls don't have, You know, souls don't have drives to, for like desires for food or for sex and, you know, to own stuff. But God puts us in a world. And because he puts us in a world, we have to know how to use the world correctly to achieve our goal. It's like anything in this world. You want to be in good shape. There's rules of eating. There's rules of exercise. There's rules of taking care of your body. If you don't do it, right, you're going to pay the consequences for it. So it's a package deal. It's a belief system that comes with certain rules and regulations. And a lot of people don't necessarily want to buy into those. It's going to mean people are going to have to not only admit that they're not necessarily doing the right thing and line up and go in a certain direction, but actually change the way they behave. So as people are going to be very threatened on the deepest possible levels with their essence of who they think they are and what they believe being challenged, you get a lot of pushback on this. And that is precisely the scenario that is mentioned, albeit vaguely, in the prophets about the final showdown, just like in the Hollywood movies, you know, before Harry Potter is going to meet Voldemort. You know, you have a big buildup to there, but there's one final showdown. So that's that final showdown. And the Messiah is not necessarily the guy who's out in the front with the sword charging at everyone. He's the catalyst for the process, but that process is definitely going to happen. And again, it doesn't have to be cataclysmic, by the way. It's very clear. One of the things that's very interesting that people need to understand when you read, you know, the books of the prophets, and we mentioned last episode that even though there's no tractate saying these are the laws of the Messiah, if you take a pen and paper and start reading through Ezekiel and Zechariah and Isaiah, you'll be able to, by what they say the world's going to look like, sketch out how the world is going to unfold. So as we get to that period of time, there's a lot of details we simply do not have. But with when you're reading, if people are going to actually do this homework assignment, so I look through the books of the prophets, you'll notice that all prophecy is divided into two parts. There's good prophecy and there's bad prophecy.
Right.
And there's a big difference. Besides, I always jokingly say, what's the difference between good and bad prophecy? Besides, you know, good makes you smile and bad you need Prozac to deal with.
Right. You know,
good prophecy is guaranteed. It has to happen. I mean, again, God he's the gamer. He's the program designer. It's going to happen. The bad prophecy is only a consequence of, or the Jewish people specifically, or humanity in general, making the wrong decisions.
Yeah, I always emphasize when I'm, you know, talking about or teaching related to prophecy, like the key word is always yet, right? Like if.
So exactly.
All those negative prophecies generally happen and they end with, you know, if, unless, you know, here's what could happen if. And it gives a lot of wiggle room to change the future. It's giving us a window. If you keep going down this road, here's what it's probably going to look like. But if you change, you know, there are other options. So it's a really interesting system in terms of it still provides for free will and choice, that we're not bound by destiny. We're given options of what that destiny could look like.
Exactly. And that what you're talking about is a macro level. I decide to do the right thing doesn't mean the world's going to go, unless I'm a person with outsized influence. Like the Jewish people, we have outsized influence. If we collectively make the right decisions, that could speed up the story. But it's very important that, you know, how quickly, how slowly, how painfully, how painlessly, that is largely up to the decisions that humanity chooses to make, and specifically the Jewish people, because we are the people who are playing this outsized role of leading the way down this path. But like we say, the greatest danger, because as it becomes clear, you know, that the world is moving towards this, we're going to reach the greatest opposition. And the greatest danger takes place at the end of the story. And that's that scenario we talk about, this final showdown, you know, this Gog and Magog story that we mentioned in the previous episode as kind of introduction, when the nations of the world, I mean, the details are missing. Yeah, the nations.
Gog and Magog?
Yeah, we don't. So the thing is, you could spend, there's a lot of different commentaries. And Maimonides, again, with all this stuff, he's so good about this. He says, we don't have, I'm paraphrasing him now exactly. He says, we don't have all the details. There's no clear tradition on it. We could only go based on what we could read in, you know, the rabbis and the books of the prophets. So like I say, the macro, the broad brushstrokes, we know what happens, you know, and what we expect to see, but the details we don't know. So the details are what we don't know. When it talks about, like we mentioned in the last episode, who these people are, Gog, Magog, Meshech, Tuval, you know, the weapons used that are described by prophets living 2,500 to 2,700 years ago, obviously are not something that's relevant to today. When they talk about horses and chariots and armies and hordes, okay, armies still exist and they can be hordes of men, but they're using very different weapons and very different technology. So we have to be careful when reading this stuff is not to try and figure out exactly what is going on there, but rather to pull out the theme, like the big themes of what we can expect to see, so that we know that what seems to be something we've only talked about literally for thousands of years is actually unfolding right before our eyes, which is really what we are basically seeing today.
Okay. Themes. What are they?
Okay. So first of all, there's a very interesting, besides the general theme of the world lining up to come against Israel, it doesn't literally mean that everyone in the world lines up against Israel, nor does every country line up against Israel. But the general mood will be that the odds and the nations are stacked against us. Now, first of all, before we go any further, that's already been happening for a very long time.
Right.
If you look at the voting.
Since the beginning of the establishment of the state, but really certainly in the last, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, really. It's been basically since the 1980s onward, with the reorientation of the conflict from Israel being the David and the Arab world being the Goliath, to Israel micratizing the conflict, which was a deliberate strategy, which we're not going to go into now, from Israel is the Goliath, and now the Palestinians are the David, and we're the foreign occupiers, and yada, yada, yada. That has definitely been changing a lot. But you can clearly see by looking at the voting record of the United Nations, an organization I am not fond of, I call it the useless nothings, that it's condemned Israel more than every other country in the world combined, obsessively. I mean, it's a joke of an organization. That's a whole topic you can talk about on its own. But really, the only thing that's keeping Israel from political isolation, we have prime ministers come and go. You know, when you had Stephen Harper, you're from Canada, he was the prime minister of Canada. He was super pro-Israel. Justin Trudeau is less so, you could go back and forth. Donald Trump is this way and Barack Obama is that way. And there's always wiggles in democracies, depending who's in power. But the general trend has been that the world has been moving more and more towards Israel's political isolation, with America being the one blocking Security Council resolutions and being the one mega superpower in a unique position to stand up for Israel. Besides that, it's basically Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, Papua New Guinea, and Vanuatu. These are teeny tiny, like Micronesia's largest export is probably its postal stamp. You know, these are countries that are incredibly pro-Israel, by the way. I highly recommend visiting exotic Polynesian and Melanesian cultures that love us. But really, the world has been moving in that way for a very long time. But the inability to define exactly what Gog and Magog is aside, there's another interesting concept. You know, Daniel, the book of Daniel is a fascinating book. It's the hardest book of all the prophets, and one of the hardest books in the Bible, in my opinion, to read. A, because it's half in Aramaic, not Hebrew, so the language is hard. And B, because it's extremely esoteric. What it talks about, there's this famous story in Daniel, but he has a vision, because a lot of the prophets, you have to understand, Eli, are not getting, unlike we mentioned in the last episode, Moses is unique in that God dictates, so to speak, word for word, which gives his prophecy a unique level of authority, which is why God dictating to Moses is what Jewish law is. It's not the laws of Moses, it's really the laws of God are dictated to Moses. But a lot of the prophets are seeing images and they're putting their own words to them. And Daniel has this image of these beasts like rising up with like this, the different claws and heads and made of different material. And again, the commentators love talking about what it means, and there's multiple interpretations, but it's generally viewed as the four ancient persecutors of the Jewish people. They're called exiles. Doesn't mean literal exiles are throwing out of our land, but some of them were exiles being thrown out of our land. But the ancient peoples, and we've come across practically all the ancient empires that have lived in the Mediterranean area and Europe and Southern Europe have come at us. But it's Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome are the four ancient oppressors of. And there are other ones in there. Assyria is not mentioned in there, but they're in there. You know, at Babylon, they destroy the first temple and exile us. Persia, you know, that's the story of Purim and the attempted genocide against the Jewish people.
Yeah.
Greece, the holiday we're coming up to now is the Hanukkah story, history's first religious ideological war. It's paganism's war against monotheism. And Rome, which we had the most tumultuously difficult relationship with, multiple revolts, destruction of temple, exile, dispersion, mass slaughter. So that those are the in the past, our nemesis. But what's interesting is there's an idea that's brought down more recently in the 16th century after the expulsion from Spain. And a lot of Jews come back to the land of Israel, is, you know, there's always a big rise in Jewish mystical thinking when cataclysmic things are going on. Because as believing Jews, especially Jews who are spiritually connected and have a lot of knowledge and the Kabbalistic mystical rabbi personalities, they're always going to want to delve into the sources to understand what are the wheels turning behind the events, like we try and do in our podcast here. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the wheels turning behind the events that are really, what's the real plot behind the smokescreen and the big headlines? What is really going on? So there's a big explosion of Kabbalistic, it's kind of like a perfect storm with the publication of the Zohar, which is this such an incredibly, very basic book of Jewish mysticism. Jewish tradition attributes it to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who wrote it 1900 years ago, hiding in a cave with his son for 12 years from the Romans in the land of Israel. There's the cataclysmic events of the expulsion of Jews from Spain and what just turned the Jewish world on end. There's the concentration of a whole bunch of really amazing scholars in Sfat, which in the 16th century become the largest Jewish community in the land of Israel with 10,000 people living in it. And it's just like when you get all these great minds, there's a synergy you connect. When you get a lot of people, you know, with great minds together, it creates an energy and a power, and they're thinking and challenging and pushing each other to be more creative on many different levels. So a lot of amazing stuff comes out of Sfat. And there's one of the great Kabbalists of that period of time is Rabbi Isaac Luria, the Ari, who dies at age 38 in Sfat. And he has a huge monumental impact on Jewish mystical thinking, on Kabbalistic understandings, a lot of traditions, you name it. He's a truly transformative personality. We lost at a very young age, but it was remarkably impactful. And he didn't write anything, but his main student, Rabbi Chaim Vital, he wrote a book called Eitz Hadas, which is the Tree of Knowledge, which is based on the teachings of his rabbi and mentor, Rabbi Isaac Luria. And he brings down that a very interesting idea. He says, and I'm going to actually read you the quote. I want to get it exactly right. This is from the Eitz Hadas. He says, at the end of days, this is the period we've been talking about. As we approach, and the last episode, we talked about where we are, the 5,784 years since the end of the sixth day of creation, the 6,000 year maximum time period that all has to happen within, which means that we are very close to the end. We're in that late Friday afternoon. If people don't know exactly what we're talking about, go back and listen to the previous episode, and we go into that in detail. Right. But this end of days is the period that as we're getting to the sunset on the Friday night of human history in that sixth millennia, that's when the Messianic era will appear. That's when the great transformation takes place. But he writes, in the end of days, Israel is destined to experience the Ishmaelite exile. This fifth and last exile will be the most difficult of all. It is the exile of Ishmael. Now, what does that mean, Ishmaelite exile? So Ishmael is the firstborn son of Abraham through his second wife, Hagar. For more on that, go read the book of Genesis. When Sarah is barren, she gives an Egyptian. One of the gifts Abraham got in Egypt was a woman named Hagar, Pharaoh's daughter. I'm sure he had many of them. He gave one to Abraham. Please take a daughter, you know. And she has a child named Ishmael in Jewish tradition. And by the way, Islamic tradition agrees with this also. He does not become the Jewish people. He's bypassed by Isaac, who is Abraham's one and only child from Sarah at a very late age. And that's a whole discussion as to why he's bypassed, but we're not going to go into that now. But from Ishmael will come A, Arabs, and B, Islam, because Islam, which today is 70% of Muslims, are not Arabs. It originates in the seventh century as a religion of nomadic Arabic speaking people, the descendants of Ishmael in the Arabian Peninsula. So they become, and it even says in the Bible that Ishmael, as a child of Abraham, is going to become a very powerful force in the world. He becomes a very powerful force physically, and a very powerful force spiritually, with the Arab world and with and Islam. But we're being told that what Chaim Vital is adding on here, and he's gotten this from his teacher, Rabbi Isaac Luria, is that there'll be a fifth beast, so to speak, to add on to Daniel's prophecy. And this will be the final, at this final showdown, somehow Ishmael and his descendants, the Arab Islamic world, is going to play a pivotal role in this, like, in trying to stop this process from happening. Even though, unlike many other people who've lived for many thousands of years, the worldview of Islam is, being an offshoot of Judaism, as is Christianity, is remarkably closer to Judaism than many, right, than any oppressors of the ancient world who gave us such hell in Daniel's prophecy.
Right.
Which begs another question.
And just as a caveat, like before we kind of dive through, like, not, like you said, look, it's, you know, we're allowed to, as Jews, pray in a mosque, but not in a church. Like we're seen as cousins. And also in Genesis, one of the most beautiful stories that's overlooked is at the very end of the Parsha, when Avram dies and Ishmael and Isaac unite to bury Avram. And it says, like, they become, like, they're together again. So there's something about the power of us together is beautiful, but when we're not, it's awful.
Yeah, exactly. And you could say that, unlike maybe the Greeks or the Romans, who were very threatened by Jewish worldview and everything that came with it in terms of moral behavior and whatever, obviously what Christian Islamic anti-Semitism, and again, we're not saying there's plenty of Christians and Muslims who are not radical and not anti-Semitic. So this is not the topic. We're talking about it on a philosophical level here, like holistically on a philosophical level of what's going on, which is it has to do with partially with them being close to us, because by definition, being particularistic faiths, one being right by definition negates the others. Even though we Jews say the righteous of the nations of the world have a place in the world to come, you cannot say, as a believing Jew, and it's not meant as an insult to Muslims or Christians, Muhammad was a prophet and Jesus was God's son. You just can't believe that. I'm not going to disrespect other people's beliefs. But just as no Muslim's going to tell you, you know, like, Moses got the Torah and the Jews got it right, and we're just like some offshoot is usurping you guys. No. So that's just the way it works here. So without going into like an in-depth discussion of what really is going on in terms of Christian and Muslim animus towards the Jews, the general theme is that when these religions come out of us, as Christianity will also come out of Jewish tradition, links Christianity back to Edom and Rome, which is Esav, which is Jacob's full brother, also in the book of Genesis. And he becomes even a greater force in the world and a greater spiritual force, even in terms of sheer numbers and sheer impact. The impact of Western civilization, Western Christian now based civilization, has been by far the most substantial in the world as a whole. These two peoples, when they come into being, and Christianity appears before Islam by many hundreds of years, by probably 300 years, we're rounding it off. We're now pushed to the sidelines. Historically, the Jews, we're living in exile, scattered around the world as a tiny fraction of different countries or different cultures or empires, populations. But now these two belief systems that are based on us are basically claiming that they're the true faiths. And they're duking it out. We've seen that going on literally for over 1,000 years, right, with jihading, you know, with Islam's rapid expansion and threatening to overwhelm Christian Europe, and with the crusader pushback multiple times, which led to massive violence and animus between these two cultures. So they're fighting each other. But what Judaism also brings down is this idea. It's very interesting. The going back to the Zohar, which is this basic book of Jewish mysticism. What is the Zohar? The Zohar, again, is a very esoteric commentary that Jewish tradition says was written by Shimon Bar Yochai when hiding in this cave from the Romans. It's in Aramaic, and it's a much deeper understanding of this, of this, what's going on behind the simple plot line of the story. The Zohar in Vayera, which is one of the Torah portions in the book of Genesis, it says, and the sons of Ishmael will fight many battles in the world, and the sons of Edom, which is Esau, which represents the Christian world, will gather against them and make war against them, some on land, others on sea, and some close to Jerusalem. and one shall prevail over the other, but the Holy Land will not be delivered to the sons of Edom. It's interesting that the Muslims dominated Israel, what is today Israel, and Jerusalem for 1,300 years. None of them had a capital here. Israel was always part of, and Jerusalem was always part of a larger Islamic empire based in Cairo, Baghdad, Istanbul, or Damascus. But for 1,300 years, which, by the way, the mystical sources say corresponds to the 13 years of Ishmael's life when he was circumcised. Hmm. He was circumcised at 13 when Isaac was circumcised at 8 days old. That's where the custom comes from in Judaism. Hmm. So there's a great story brought down in the Jewish mystical tradition that is a reward for him getting circumcised at 13 years old. Ishmael's physical or spiritual descendants, Islam, will control the land of Israel for 1,300 years, which is exactly what it works out to, by the way, from the 7th century to the 20th century is 1,300 years. So they're duking it out kind of on a physical level, and empires, and also, but on a theological level. So and we're kind of pushed to the side. We don't represent a threat to anyone. We're insignificant. We've lost our country. But what happens as part of this whole process we've been talking about is as we return, now that's exactly what's happened in the last 100 years. This vision of a few Eastern European Jews that was then joined by this very driven Hungarian Jew living in Vienna in the late 19th century named Theodor Herzl makes what seems to be a dream a reality, an impossible, unique historical experience of a nation that went twice into exile, the last time for 2,000 years, and survived persecutions and destruction and comes back and founds a state. It's a reality. So this is like kind of like a bucket of ice water in the face of both these other faiths, which believed in different ways that the exile and the suffering the Jews have gone under, because clearly if God chose you, you wouldn't be in such a bad situation. Not a very nuanced understanding of God, by the way. We don't view God as Guido the bodyguard. We pay him off and he takes care of us. We understand we have a contractual arrangement with the creator of the universe. We keep our side of the bargain. He keeps his. And if we don't, there are huge consequences. And since God doesn't like to zap us with lightning bolts and things like that, he will find other nations to give us a smack, depending upon how.
It's interesting. Sometimes like thinking about that is like, God's not our bodyguard. God's our personal trainer.
That's a very good way of putting it. I like that a lot. That's a very good way of putting it.
We're just going to keep getting pushed.
That's a very good. So we understand. We're looking at it differently. We're not looking at God rejected us. They often, Christianity came out very strongly with this idea that, Jews rejected God and his son Jesus. So God rejected them and destroyed their temple and exiled them. And the only reason why they survive is so when Jesus comes at the end of days, a concept they took from us, and he is the Messiah, having finally fulfilled the job description that he did not fulfill 2,000 years ago, we'll save that for a different class, then the Jews will finally recognize that we were wrong 2,000 years ago. So, but bottom line, to take what is a very complicated topic, because we're getting to the end of our time here, I know, but basically the way we understand what's going on now, literally in the news every day, is part of this process of Israel has moved so much in a way that has been subtle, but nonetheless supernatural. And because it's happened in ways that are all naturally explained, none of it involves any suspension of the laws of nature, but the reestablishment of the Jewish state, the fact that I mentioned also last time that, almost no Jews in the world lived in Israel, half of 1%, and now half the Jews in the world are living in Israel, and whole areas that, like this former Russia Empire, which was where all the Jews in the world were living basically 100 right. years ago, are now being denuded of their Jewish population. You literally see the diaspora shutting down. It's one of the byproducts of rising anti-Semitism and political instability is Jews coming back to the land of Israel. Places like France, every French Jew I know owns an apartment somewhere in Netanya.
And is this part then of this Ishmaelite exile? Are you saying all of this is contextually underneath that? And I mean, look, really what we all want to know is like, how does it work out? How does it end?
Right. Right. So exactly. So it's part of this final showdown, but the tip of the spear that's coming to try and stop us from this, because again, with the actualization of all of us reaching the end game will be the recognition, going back to cognitive dissonance, that this is the truth. This is the reality. And whether you like it or not, like gravity, you disobey it, has consequences. This is what it's going to be. So the idea is the world is moving towards this endgame war of Gog and Magog, but the Ishmaelite part of it is exactly this point, which is, again, going back to the Zohar. It's very interesting. in Genesis, it says the children of Ishmael, meaning the Arab, the Islamic world, is destined at this time, as all the things we're talking about that we're living through now. Listen to what it says. He's saying this 2,000 years ago. Is destined to incite all the nations of the world to come to Jerusalem together with them, as it is written in Zechariah in chapter 14, verse 2 of Zechariah. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem for war, which means the big picture of the world lining up, Gog and Magog, is happening. But the details that Chaim Vital is bringing in is that the leader, the tip of the spear, that's going to be the point, literally, geographically, physically, and in terms of rallying the world around it, is going to be the Arab Islamic world, which is exactly what is happening now. And with Maimonides, by the way, who is a very rationalist guy. We don't think of Kabbalistic mystical stuff when you think of Maimonides. He's the most rationalist of anyone I could think of, as one of the great rabbinic personalities. Mm-hmm. You know, he writes in, and when he's writing to the Jews of Yemen, and the Jews of Yemen going back to the 12th century were undergoing forced conversion at the hands of the Muslims in Yemen. He wrote letters, he corresponded with them to strengthen them spiritually. And look what he writes. It's really interesting. And again, he's saying this basically a little less than 1,000 years ago. But regarding the time of the Messianic era is what he's referring to. It has already been made clear by the words of Daniel, we mentioned him already, Isaiah, and the rabbis of blessed memory, that the coming of the Messiah will take place when the hand of Edom, which is Western civilization, and the Arab world will be mighty, and their rule will spread throughout the world. This is exactly what is going on. This is Maimonides, who's not a prophet, mm-hmm. writing almost 1,000 years ago. He said, there is no doubt about this matter. A very emphatic statement, very unusual for Maimonides to say things like this. For it says, he will see a chariot and a pair of horsemen, a chariot with a donkey. He's quoting Isaiah now. It's chapter 21 of Isaiah. The chariot with the donkey is the Messiah. The pair of horsemen represents men of war. That is to say, the alliance of two nations, Edom and Ishmael. Which again, Ali, brings us back to the weirdest kind of alliance you see, which is the liberal democratic Western world united with the radical Islamic world. Not the whole, right. The whole Islamic world is not radicalized. There are like 55 wow. states that have Islam as their religion and 22 states of the Arab League, but it's certainly been basically co-opted by the most, with Iran at the center, the most radical form of the Islamic world was leading the charge.
So, right, meaning like when we're on TikTok and we see kids in university now saying they want to convert to Islam, or that Osama bin Laden was right, or chanting Free Palestine in the streets. It's pretty shocking, you know, that 10 years ago, this idea that suddenly all the college campus kids would want to convert to Islam or be completely embedded with the Arab world and radical jihadists was like, what are you talking about? But that's literally what we're seeing.
Exactly. And it's not just college campuses, by the way. Europe, which I always say 1,000 years ago, you had crazy Christians screaming Dus Vult, which is Latin for God wills it, fighting with Muslims who were screaming Allahu Akbar, God is great. Two very particularistic monotheistic worldviews that believed very much in their own worldview, fighting with each other over who's right. Europe has largely moved away from religion, especially Western Europe. And the further north mm-hmm. you go, the less religious it is. This is not true of Eastern Europe, by the way, which is much more particularistic. Still believes in its identity and much more spiritual. But they're basically opening their doors up to waves of Muslims. And again, it's not all of them, of course. And by the way, a lot of the Muslims who fled to these European countries fled to escape the totalitarian closed-mindedness, right. And their children have been radicalized. So now yeah. they're being overrun. Look at the protests taking place being led by Muslims, which are often getting just falling into riots and genocidal
things, and, jihad
and stuff like that. But that's one way you're seeing it. And these two worldviews should have nothing. Liberal democratic Europe has absolutely nothing in common with the extreme Islamic worldview that is coming from places like Iran and being pushed onto the world by the Houthis and, you know, the Hamas and Hezbollah and you name it, wherever it is. And even in Africa, it's everywhere. But the worst example, and this is what we're talking about, this is the red-green alliance. This is what Maimonides is talking about, the red-green. Red is the color, it's Esav. Doesn't mean like we're talking about Republicans, Democrats, blue and red. Esav is referred to as the red. That's Christian Western, not necessarily Christian, but it's the culture that comes from Christian Western Europe versus the green, which is the Islamic color. All their flags are green. All their mosques are green lights. This is an alliance which makes no sense. And you see it, as you pointed out perfectly, when you see like LGBTQ feminist activist walking with a keffiyeh around her neck, arm in arm with a radical jihadi guy who's got his face covered and he's got like the Hamas thing on his forehead. These are the kind of people who in their own country, we'd be killing those people.
Right.
There's not a lot of tolerance for LGBTQ people, and feminism is a non-event in extreme Islamic states. The Taliban, don't let them forget it.
So on an actual values level, completely don't align. But where they exactly. do align is that Jews and Israel are the enemy.
Right. So again, we're not talking about all Christians and all Muslims, but the fundamental issue here is, even though it's really weird, because sometimes the people who are the closest to you fight the most with you. It's not because, by the way, the Christian world that is totally bought into the Bible, which is a new thing in Christianity. It's a whole interesting discussion. We could have an episode on that one also. The impact of the Bible is amazing. But the Christian world that finally reads the Bible, albeit in translation, is totally bought into it. It takes it literally. Are the Christians who tend to be A, highly moral people, in my opinion, and B, very pro-Israel and very supportive of Jews, because they actually put their own sectarian worldview and desires aside and bought into the bigger picture of this God-based faith that comes from Judaism.
Right.
Islam, by the way, doesn't have our Bible in their Quran. It references things in Judaism, but it's not there. But just
although
because
there is, just to say, there is a radical right faction of Adama, the Christian world, which is the white supremacists. Like there's the left, but there's also on the right. And, you know, so you could kind of complete that picture of the feminist LGBTQ person walking arm in arm with a Hamas terrorist. On the other side would be, you know, the white supremacist that, you know, says Jews will not replace us. So, you know, that kind of creates the triad of what's happening in North America today, where suddenly all of these people who do not align in any way on any values whatsoever are deeply on side with each other in terms of a common, what they perceive as an enemy.
Right. So when we see the Proud Boys marching with Black Lives Matter and the LGBTQ Pride right. Parade, then right. we know we're really close. But yeah. But bottom line is, the point to focus on is that on the deepest level, and they're not aware, they're not saying this. We have to understand that much of what drives the animus towards the Jewish people, and by the way, Israel bashing is just the final form anti-Semitism is taking, is often subconscious. It's a deep, even subliminal subconscious awareness of the threat that the Jews pose, not on a material level, not on a physical level, not an empire level, but an ideological level. This is the ultimate challenge. The teeny tiny Jewish people who have never given in to other people's beliefs, who have transformed the world and died for their beliefs, you know? So so these people will put their differences aside, because as much as they might not like each other, they realize that the mothership, the teeny mothership, is really Judaism and the Jewish people. If we were to disappear, by the way, they go back to slaughtering each other en masse.
Right. The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, we serve a purpose. And so that is really, so to put this all in context, now we understand that as we approach the end of the story, and we clearly are getting near it, we see what is unfolding in front of our eyes, what you watch in the news today of, okay, because of the atrocities that Hamas committed, you have governments came out strongly in front of Israel, but there's so much kind of support going on. How many people are conflicted, especially the younger they are, and supporting Hamas and globalize the jihad and stuff like that. It's all part of this process of confusion, lack of clarity, and it's really dragging the world kicking and screaming towards what is ultimately the issue of truth. And the ultimate truth is God and how we relate to God correctly, which is our job, is to be the conduit to do that. So bottom line, this all kind of fits in really perfectly to the end of day scenario. We're just missing, you know, like, you know, God forbid, you see the U.S. decides to go neutral on the situation.
Yeah.
And then we have a perfect end of day scenario lined up, where the world is not necessarily everyone literally sending armies against us, but there's the people who are attacking us directly. And there's the people who are standing behind them and supporting them. And then there's a lot of people standing on the sidelines and watching it happen, who are guilty by association or by apathy.
Right. Right.
So clearly, okay, so it's kind of scary, but it's also kind of cool, because that means, okay, you know, that the big wheels are turning. We are really getting to the end. But what it really means for us is, this is a big wake-up call. Mm-hmm. This is a huge inflection point in Jewish history, in the history of Israel, in the history of the Jewish people. in a conflict which is so unambiguously what is right and wrong and good and evil, yet people are equivocating on it, and the whole inability to make statements about truth and give people facts is only adding to what is really the ultimate struggle here, which is on who's going to live in reality, who's going to deny reality. Living right. reality means living with God. Living in ultimate reality is backing the Jewish people, who are the connectors to God. And the other side is going to be being against the Jewish people, against Israel, and ultimately against the values that God gives to the world, which makes that evil.
Okay, so but now there's like a million different episodes that are coming out of this that we actually have to talk about, because I think this brings us, number one, I think it'd be really helpful if we do an episode on the history of truth. I think that yes. would be really, really helpful, because I think it's one of the things that everyone is struggling with the most. Is there such a thing as objective truth? Is it really totally subjective truth? Is there something in between those two things? Especially when everybody is saying, you know, well, this is my truth and that's your truth, and we can just agree to disagree. I would love to do an episode on the history of truth. I think that the other piece of the puzzle, you mentioned it just really in passing, this whole idea of BDS has been coming up a lot again today. I think it would be really helpful to talk about the history of that. And then the other thing I just want to mention that we, again, sort of skimmed over at one point is this whole idea of Christianity and the overlap with Islam. Because right now, one of the huge claims that I'm seeing online is this whole idea that Jesus actually wasn't Jewish, that Jesus was an Arab Palestinian. And I want to start to unpack that in terms of understanding that who was Jesus and how is that related to the Jewish people, and how does that work for or against us in terms of the truth narrative. So I feel like we have lots to talk about, but I love that this brings us to the main piece, which is this is a time where we're called to action related to what's true.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The big wake-up call. And I think everyone feels it. The Jewish world is definitely feeling it. I'm not so sure how much the rest of the world is feeling it.
Yeah.
But the Jewish world is, I think a lot of my evangelical Christian acquaintances see it, because they know yeah. this, they read the prophets. But even Jews who are very disconnected, I think, are feeling that, whoa, even though my Jewish identity right. might be very secondary to who I look at, suddenly everyone's reminding me that it's really how they're looking at me, you know?
Which yeah, is, and I would also say, like, for the Jews that aren't feeling it, I think it would be a really helpful, curious question. Why not? And I think for people who are morally concerned about life, I would also be saying, why not? You know, like, I mean, there's certainly some incredible, I mean, being at the Ottawa rally yesterday, there's some really incredibly clear allies who are not Jewish, but just see this absolutely crystal clear that this is a moral war. This is a moral stance. This is a question of what are your morals? What are your values? And they're super clear about it. You know, from the Carolyn DeMore, who like makes pasta sauces in Malibu and has bright pink hair, to like Rex Murphy, who's a journalist in Canada and, you know, couldn't remember if it was November or October 7th, but he was absolutely morally clear. And I think that question of, as a Jew, if you're not feeling that tug right now, and if you're non-Jewish, you're not feeling that tug right now to clarify what's important in life, I think it's just a really good question to say why.
Is that's very good. That's a great topic of discussion. Why do we care about any of this? It has a lot more to right. do with Palestinians, Israel, the Middle East. We're dealing with really the ultimate questions and the biggest issues. And like everything in the world, it's going to be focused on the little Jewish people.
Yep.
Like I said, like we always say, being Jewish might not be comfortable, but it's always going to be meaningful. Right. And the world's always going to
and the world's always going to remind us.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally. Amazing. Okay, so we'll continue next week. Thank you so much. A couple things maybe just to throw in at the end of today's episode. Number one, of course, you know, praying for the safety and the security of the soldiers, of the Jewish people, of the hostages, all of those things as we do any of our learning. Number two, Rabbi Kent Spiro is planning to come to North America soon. So stay tuned for information about that. And please, if you enjoy the podcast, please like, share, subscribe. You know, we're trying to be here for people who are looking for information. So if you can help us get there, get out there to people who are looking for us, that would be super helpful. Thanks everyone for joining.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.